This is the Real World DevOps Podcast, and I'm your host, Mike Julian. I'm setting out to meet the most interesting people doing awesome work in the world of DevOps, from the creators of your favorite tools to the organizers of amazing conferences. From the authors of great books to fantastic public speakers, I want to introduce you to the most interesting people I can find. This episode is sponsored by the lovely folks at Influx Data. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably also interested in better monitoring tools, and that's where Influx comes in. Personally, I'm a huge fan of their products, and I often recommend them to my own clients. You're probably familiar with their time series database, InfluxDB, but you may not be as familiar with their other tools. Telegraph for metrics collection from systems, Chronograph for visualization, and Capacitor for real-time streaming. All of these are available as open source and as a hosted SaaS solution. You can check all of it out at InfluxData.com. My thanks to Influx Data for helping make this podcast possible. Hi, folks. I'm Mike Julian, your host for the Real World DevOps Podcast. My guest this week is Kelly Shortridge, the VP of Product at Capsulate and an internationally known speaker on InfoSec topics. So, Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
I was looking at your LinkedIn and there was something that kind of stood out to me was your FINRA license. You started your career off in finance.
That's so, like, true.
What in the world happened there? How does that work?
Yeah, how does that even happen? So FINRA exams are very painful, so I didn't want to, have to re-up those. But mostly, I started my career doing mergers and acquisitions, covering information security companies. And while I quite liked the finance side, I noticed that security had a ton of opportunity, not just as far as like vendors, but the problem space is huge and it's very unsolved and the incentive problems are enormous. So for someone like myself who had studied some behavioral economics, just all of the messy incentive problems were kind of like catnip for me. So I knew I had to go into the industry.
Yeah. The behavioral economics side, like the study of incentives, that's absolutely fascinating to me because it, especially in security and systems, everything we do is incentives based. And it's often incentives that we're not even paying attention to, things we don't even think about.
Like, that's definitely true.
Yeah, like you make it hard to use two-factor and like people aren't going to use two-factor.
Yep, so that's something that I feel like people outside of security understand immediately, but inside security, they don't always understand the fact that if you don't make something that integrates into workflows, people are going to bypass it. But you're absolutely right. There's such a kind of web of incentives. And on the one hand, you have things that are explicitly stated, security or privacy is important to us. But then you have more of the tacit goals and priorities, which are that, well, security is a cost center. And really what matters is being able to deliver on time and, releasing at a certain cadence. So those tacit assumptions also create a bunch of incentive problems in InfoSec. But I always think that InfoSec, because they wish they were more relevant, try to be the culture of no and ram through really annoying technologies for people to use just to show that they're still relevant.
That hits home. Like, yeah. I've seen that way too many times.
Yeah, I think most developers, it's not really a love-hate relationship. It's mostly just a hate relationship for the most part, somewhat bidirectional.
What really about security drew you away from finance? Have you found there's good parallels that you've been seeing?
It's interesting. There's certainly parallels, particularly on the risk management side, particularly anything around like risk centrality, because that's a huge part of financial systems. So that's not really what I did day to day. I think what's interesting in security is there's a huge lack of effective communication. Even when you go to conferences, there will be sick O-Day that's dropped or whatever, but it's often not communicated very well. And certainly when you look at enterprises, security priorities aren't really communicated well to the rest of the business. And a lot of investment banking is frankly effective communication. It's about quickly researching something in general companies and understanding it very deeply to be able to talk about it and effectively persuade acquirers that it's worth acquiring a company. And so frankly, even the Excel and PowerPoint skills I learned along the way are really helpful and just being able to talk to people about security. You know, I can speak to CEOs, I can speak to board members, I can speak to DevOps people about security in a way that's still understandable. And that's what I feel like we're still missing a lot of in information security.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I was reading one of your articles. I can't remember which one it is. I'll have to go find it and throw it in the show notes. But you made mention of attacks from nation states. And I thought that was pretty interesting. It definitely stood out to me. And perhaps I have a bit more security exposure to that side of things than the average DevOps person might. I worked for the government for a while, so I've seen it. But for the vast majority of people who haven't, what is a nation state? Like, what are we talking about when in security context?
Nation states, generally in the context of an attacker, is a government-sponsored entity. So in some cases, it gets a bit blurry, particularly with China or Russia, where you have criminal groups that either lightly or strongly have the backing of the government, or at least the government looks the other way because it still benefits, you know, the government's goals. But in general, it means a nation state attacker. And you'll also hear the term APT, which is an advanced persistent threat. Part of the reason why they can be advanced and persistent is because they're well-resourced and they're also well-motivated. They have very stated goals and they have actual budgets that can go towards poning things.
This is actually a thing? Like, this is actually happening?
It is actually happening. So the extent to which it's happening, particularly for the average organization, I think is a bit more dubious. I think by far and away the script kiddie threat or the criminal group threat is far bigger. And that's where, for example, why I transitioned to security, looking at behavioral economics, there's a concept called prospect theory. And part of that is basically people overweight small probabilities and underweight large probabilities. So, for example, you overweight the probability that a shark's going to eat you and you underweight the probability that, you know, you'll be hit by a car or, you know, succumb to some sort of car accident. The same applies in security, that people vastly underweight the fact that probably they'll succumb to phishing or some other sort of kind of like somewhat stupid scripted attack. And then they overweight how much, you know, Mossad is the classic example. Mossad's going to, you know, find, you know, who your secretary is, and they're going to like install some special sort of pen that then transmits, you know, some sort of exploit over to, you know, his or her machine. And then that machine's going to exfiltrate data by fluctuating the power supply. And someone's then hacked into the power plant to like read that. All of that stuff is more like fan fiction than anything else, except for, you know, national laboratories or governments, maybe Fortune 10s. So in general, people definitely like how sexy nation states are as far as this kind of attacker, because no one wants to be owned by like a 12-year-old, right? That feels bad.
That's just embarrassing.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think that's why there's so much focus on nation states rather than kind of the quotidian threats.
I got to see James Mickens mm-hmm. Speak a while back. And one of his slides it basically just said the threat model is Mossad or not Mossad.
Absolutely. Yes.
if it's Mossad, you're screwed anyways. Like, yep. Don't bother. Give up. You're done. If it's not Mossad, well, now we can have a conversation about what you can do.
Precisely. And that goes into a really good threat modeling in the sense that, you know, even with, I think it was APT-28, which most people know as the one that, you know, hacked the DNC, they tried phishing first. I think it was something like Google-admin, but the Google had two zeros and maybe, you know, people should have spotted it. I tend not to blame users for those sorts of errors. But the point is that even these super sophisticated groups will absolutely try phishing and absolutely will try these unsophisticated methods first, because if they don't have to blow something expensive like a zero-day vulnerability, which takes tons of time to research and perfect and get reliable, like, they won't do it. They'll absolutely try low-hanging fruit. I think it's similar with a lot of developers. If they don't have to like reinvent the wheel and create something fancy, they won't. Like, people tend to optimize for like what's quick and what works.
Right. Yeah. When I used to work for Oak Ridge National Lab, one of the first things that we were taught was, you don't plug in USB drives from outside of here, mm-hmm. and, you know, be very careful about what links you click in an email. And the FBI came around through the InfraGuard program to tell us that it basically gave us this briefing on system administrators by nation states they're kind of at the core of who they're targeting because they have tons of access and no one pays attention to them.
Definitely.
That was kind of scary when I first heard it. And then I realized, well, actually, what they're going to be doing is just coming in at the lowest level possible. Like, here, plug in this USB drive.
Exactly.
They're not going to be like a beautiful woman in a bar trying to find me in like this long 18-month process. It's just not going to happen.
Right. Yeah. If the the USB stick in the parking lot works, like, you might as well try it. And then after that, you know, it's some, you know, discounted Newegg on something in an email. Right. And then it escalates from there. Right.
Yeah, exactly. They're not starting at the top.
Exactly. Like, it completely defies human nature to think that they would start with, you know, the most expensive option rather than exhausting kind of the rest of the options.
The threat modeling here is really interesting to me, because since any attacker is going to be starting with the cheapest, perhaps most effective option, that means how I'm thinking about my defense is also going to be very different. I'm not protecting against these really fantastical situations. I'm protecting against phishing links.
Yes.
As far as like when I'm trying to design some sort of security posture, and like, I'm a DevOps engineer, I don't have any standard security staff, I don't have any specialists around me, what can I do?
So one thing that I definitely recommend is, and it's actually lucky because it's somewhat easy, is just go through kind of, you know, 101 guides on how to, you know, hack web applications. Because whatever the 101 guide says is probably what the kind of minimum viable threat model is, right? It's the same thing with corporate security. Like, going through and trying to crack passwords is probably step one, using some sort of dictionary. Obviously, something like two-factor kind of mitigates that. So what I've proposed before is the concept of decision trees, which I assume a lot of the audience will be pretty familiar with them. But if you're not, it's basically the idea that you start with, okay, you have the state of the world, you have some sort of attacker, and you have, let's say, an application that contains sensitive information. Obviously, the attacker isn't going to care about the non-sensitive information. They'll probably go for whatever the, you know, let's say credit card data. Then you figure out, okay, what's the easiest way the attacker will get there? So I have this notion called YOLOSEC, which is basically if you do nothing and you just hope that security will happen out of the ether. That would be, for example, like if you're storing the credentials in a database, like you don't have any network segmentation, you don't have any data tokenization, you certainly don't have any like access control on it. So that would be the YOLOSEC option. And so then when you start thinking about, okay, if we did absolutely nothing, what would be the easiest thing for the attacker to do? You can start eliminating those paths and then forcing the attacker down the hardest paths possible, which again eliminates a lot of the, you know, the very common script kiddie threat. Then you move up to eliminating, you know, the common criminal group threat. And finally, again, once you get to the Mossad level, like, just don't care about Mossad. Like, they're going to find a way regardless. So as long as you keep forcing attackers down that harder path, you're going to, frankly, eliminate yourself as a target.
That's fantastic advice. And for whatever reason, and I'm kind of ashamed to admit this now, I never considered looking at the 101 attack guides to figure out how to set up my defense.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you want to role play a bit, it's like, okay, imagine you're, you know, a teenager, you know, the stereotypical teenager in Eastern Europe, like, what would you do first? You know that, you know, I assume probably a lot of your listeners are at technology companies, you know, of technology company through, you know, an article in TechCrunch, you know that they have, you know, sensitive, you know, customer communication, something like that. Okay, now you think, how am I going to hack them? You're probably going to go to really stupid guides at first. So just look at those and eliminate all of those stupid ways, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Had to consider, but you're absolutely right. Yeah. So you and I were talking before we started recording about DevOps people and security people.
Yes.
And you have opinions on this. Can you tell me more?
I do, and I'm a bit of a traitor in that I definitely empathize more with the DevOps side than the security side of things. But
why is that?
It's that way because I really dislike the notion that I see a lot in security, which is, again, that culture of no. It's that notion that there's this almost, I almost call it this moral and almost like missionary perspective of like there's this abstract, perfect security archetype, and every company has to meet it. And anyone who violates security is just, you know, violating divine blessing or something like that. It's just very, it's very overly serious to a certain extent. And there's this lack of self-awareness that security most of the time slows companies down, and that if security isn't working on behalf of the business to make sure the business can survive and not choking out those workflows, then what is it doing? Like, if it's hindering the business, then you might as well have not deployed security at all, because frankly, most of the consequences of any sort of breach are reasonably minimal, particularly with the rise of like cyber insurance. That means you'll get reimbursed for incidents. So to me, like DevOps at least understands like, okay, like we are supporting money-making activities, but also like we do face cost constraints and stuff. Security doesn't quite have that same level of self-awareness, and they certainly aren't making money for the business. So again, I empathize more with the people that seem to be supporting the business more than not. And I do, in my experience, think that when I talk to DevOps people about security, they're way more receptive than when I try to talk to security people about DevOps and what they can learn. So that's part of why I side more on the DevOps side. But my thesis right now, which I've been harping at least for a year now, is that DevOps and security should actually be BFFs. Right now they're frenemies, but they shouldn't be. But there are obviously a bunch of cultural challenges. There's a ton of scar tissue, but ultimately with the rise of something like resilience engineering, you can extend the concept of like, okay, assume that things are going to fail to assume that things are going to fail also in a security context, like there will be a breach. So really there's a lot of common ground that I think both teams, so to speak, don't realize exists.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about those cultural challenges you mentioned.
There are a ton of cultural challenges. So for one, security people tend to have the break it mindset rather than the build it mindset. And they tend to think that, most people who don't consider security first are kind of stupid. So if you aren't beginning your design phase with, architecting perfect security, a lot of times they'll just think that, developers are fundamentally less intelligent. That's something I've legitimately heard. And I think that's stupid in itself, right? It's just,
yeah, that's awful.
Yeah. There are different priorities, obviously. I think on the DevOps side, there's also this notion of, it's the, fail faster. Maybe I'm just quoting Silicon Valley at this point, but, building things not necessarily with regard for security, which also isn't great because security still is a part of like managing business risk. So I think it's fundamentally, those mindsets are really different. And frankly, the best security people I know are the ones who have developer experience. And even on the DevOps side, like the ones who tend to consider security tend to be, I think, better in organizations. Like I love the stat from the State of DevOps report by Dr. Forsgren, where it states that companies that resolve security incidents more quickly and also have security sooner in the build phase actually reduce any time to recovery. It actually benefits the business and it benefits like velocity when you're considering security. It's just, are you doing it in the right way?
Have you ever read The Phoenix Project?
I have not.
Oh, it's a really great book by Gene Kim.
Okay.
And there's how it opens up is talking about this, this archetype of a security professional. And, this person, I think they named him John. It's a parable. It's really quick read, really enjoyable. But this character, John, does all this bunch of stuff and just like isn't telling anyone that he's doing it. And then the entire application completely crashes.
I believe it.
And then he starts like blaming everyone else and like, oh, well, none of you care about security and I'm the only one protecting this company. And like all of you else only care about making money. And like, we got to save this.
Exactly.
And like, then it progresses through and there's kind of the security person changes their mindset over time with the input and experience of talking to other people to realize like, well, no, like there are actually layers of security and I may not see them all.
Exactly.
So the example given in the book was the security person wanted to encrypt a field with CVVs or something like that. And it later came out that was completely unnecessary because finance had paper controls to handle it all.
Okay.
So it was completely a moot point. But in doing so, he actually broke the entire business as a result of making this completely unnecessary change because he was only seeing things from his perspective.
Yes. Yeah, I feel like half of my talks around conferences are about seeing things from other people's perspectives and teaching security people how to do that. So I'm not sure if the parable has been fully digested yet in InfoSec, but I think it's a good one.
Like hearing everything you're saying, I'm like, surely we've solved this by now, but apparently not.
No, I mean, if you look, one meme that I really hate, and if you hear security people telling you this, don't believe them, is that, the pace of attacks and, attackers shifting methods. It's just evolving constantly and we could never keep up. That's just not true. Like for the most part, if you look at underlying techniques, they don't change that much. I mean, even phishing is something that was happening in the 90s. So fundamentally,
that's interesting.
Yeah, fundamentally things don't change all that much. Though I do think on the positive side of things, some of the new technology around infrastructure is actually changing things for the better. But otherwise, like if someone is saying that they can't keep up with the pace of change, it means that they don't have good underlying basics in place. And so they are just constantly reactive. And that's a huge problem. Security is very few people are proactive and thinking, frankly, more in the DevOps kind of like architectural view rather than in just like, oh, there's a fire, must put it out. Okay, next fire, et cetera.
Right. So I want to get into that, but I have one other question before we talk about that area. So we've been talking about this terrible archetype of security people. Mm-hmm. Some of the people listening have security staff that they may not have the best of relationships with. What can they do to start to bridge that gap? Like you mentioned that DevOps and security should really be BFFs. Mm-hmm. BFFs, like, how do we get there if we're not already?
So one reason why I like resilience is because of all the commonalities there are with security. So I think even starting with a conversation about like, okay, listen, we want to make sure that our apps have really good uptime and they aren't disrupted somehow because we have to be performant. What are some of the security benefits there? Is there a way that maybe we can collaborate to make sure that part of that uptime, for example, like reduces the threat of like denial of service? That's something that I think both goals have in common, kind of looking for what are you working on and where could that somehow apply to security, I think is a good first step. Also just acknowledging it's a bit of, I guess, ego stroking and nudging in a certain way, but acknowledging like, listen, we think security is really important. Like we're looking to like implement X technology, kind of leading into kind of the next discussion we'll have, like, what are some of the security benefits here? Like with service meshes, for example, like, is there a way that like this orchestration can actually reduce work for you? Like we know that you're super busy and you're putting out a ton of fires. Like, is there some way that we can actually help automate this for you? Because we're going to automate some stuff ourselves. So I think those are the sort of olive branches I would recommend. It's kind of like, you don't want to tell them they're unimportant. That's the thing, right? That's their biggest fear in a certain way. But I think sometimes they just fundamentally don't realize they see new technology as something almost scary. And it's another, again, fire they have to put out. It's another threat model they have to create. So figuring out, okay, like we're frankly going to do this regardless. Like what are the ways that we can reduce work for them is something that I think for the most part, security people will be really receptive to that.
I have found that telling a security team that thinks like that, hey, by the way, we're going to churn all of the servers every couple days or every couple minutes. Mm-hmm. Like we're just going to rotate the entire infrastructure. And also, by the way, we're going to consistently break our own infrastructure intentionally. Mm-hmm. And you just see their heads explode. Like, you can't do that.
Yes. So here's my counter, because this is something I've been talking about constantly and we'll keep talking about is something like that, what you just mentioned. Remember back to that nation state and the APT? Well, the P in that is persistence. And it turns out it's really hard to persist on something that's constantly rotating, right? So there are actually security benefits. So you can tell them, no, you can even like drop my name, not that I'm super important, but say like, listen, I heard that it's really hard for attackers to persist if like our infrastructure is constantly rotating. Another thing, like I've constantly mentioned how Chaos Monkey is actually a really good security tool, not just a resilience tool for that reason, because it reduces persistence. Again, bringing up Service Mesh, like I've only personally scratched the surface, but I promise you most security people know nothing about it. And I guarantee you they don't know the fact that it means that they don't have to manage individual Blinky boxes anymore, that they can actually deploy like firewall rules and access control and stuff like that in a much friendlier manner. So I think it's trying to, and this is where I put the onus more on security to understand the technology rather on DevOps to understand kind of the threat models and the security needs. But going back to, if you create a really basic threat model, right, and you go through those 101 things, and every time you're looking at new technology, like you mentioned, thinking about, okay, how would this stop kind of the script kiddie? Like, where would this make it difficult for them? And presenting that to the security team is a really effective way to kind of remind them, like, listen, this isn't scary. This is something that can actually help you.
Yeah. It's hard to not be scared when you're going to security conferences. Like,
yes,
until recently I lived in San Francisco. So RSA conference is there every year, and walking the floor of RSA, it's hard to not think the world is burning and everything is awful.
It's so true. There's so much FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt in all of the marketing messaging. I personally hate it. I think it's totally unnecessary. But yeah, I mean, I think security, the industry itself really tries to be inaccessible and sound scary, which totally hurts it. And then they complain about the fact that there's a security skills shortage. And it's like, well, you're kind of presenting the industry like a nightmare. Like, no wonder people don't want to join in with you.
Right.
So I definitely quibble with that. But I think remembering that security fundamentally is about, in this digital age, as businesses are just inevitably, they have to be in the digital world, just making sure they can survive. That's fundamentally what security is about. Like, there are digital risks, and how can we make sure the business can still survive and ideally thrive with those digital risks? When you remove the nation state stuff and, you know, the ODAY and the FUD and all of that, when you make it that simple, I think it's a lot more accessible, and it starts to make a lot more sense as far as what you should do strategically.
If I'm looking at security products, like something to help me, should I just like categorically ignore all the ones that are using FUD in marketing?
I think you may be left with basically no products, to be honest. I think.
Well, that sucks.
Yeah, it does suck. It's incredibly difficult even for seasoned security professionals to navigate it. You know, there's CISOs with 20 years of experience that still talk to me about how difficult they find it just to figure out what a company is actually doing, particularly with the rise of like AI and machine learning and everything. Then they just hand wave and say, oh, it's our crystal ball. Don't worry about it. Which is helpful for no one. So I think if you're a systems administrator or a DevOps person looking at security tools, the key thing to ask, I would say, is start with the workflows. Like, make sure that you're not going to be adding undue work, because if something, you know, some what are called SIEMs, I think like Splunk and other things that basically ingest a bunch of data and help you manage alerts and stuff like that, sometimes those can add like 30 hours of work a month just to maintain them, right?
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
They're really difficult to implement. And this is often across the board with security products. They're really difficult to maintain. So just starting even with like, okay, but what's the realistic, you know, essentially costs of using your product on an ongoing basis, I think will help you a lot, because security shelfware isn't going to help anyone. I think the other thing is specifically looking at the site to see, are they kind of paying attention? Do they at least acknowledge that that's even a pain point? Because companies that are just hyping up again, like the machine learning or the AI and stuff like that, and not talking about like optimizing workflows or reducing manual effort, those are the ones that probably in general aren't going to provide as much value again, because either they're going to sit there or they're going to be so time consuming that you can't actually focus on more strategic projects.
It has been absolutely fantastic chatting with you.
Thank you so much. Like, yeah.
I've learned a ton. This is great.
Yes, definitely. And yes, anyone listening, feel free to always talk to me, because I'm always looking to see how we can, don't tell the security people, but how to make security teams a little more obsolete and integrate it more into the DevOps process itself.
Well, on that note, where can people find you?
Yes, so I have a website, swagitda.com. It's S-W-A-G-I-T-D-A. It's a finance joke for another time, but I have both speaking and writing sections, which includes kind of blog posts, both long form and shorter, as well as some of the conference presentations I've given. And that word, swagitda, is also where you can find me on Twitter and reach out.
Well, fantastic. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mike.
And to the rest of you, thanks for listening to the Real World DevOps podcast. If you want to stay up to date on the latest episodes, you can find us at realworlddevops.com and on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever it is you get your podcasts. I'll see you in the next episode.
This has been a Humble Pod production.
Stay humble.